Hanging with Levy Dalton, and this is I'll Drink to That, a weekly behind-the-scenes look at the wine business.
And it's time for the warm-up with Aaron Scala.
All right, everyone. Today I have a fun game for you. So once in a while, a brave guest will try to pronounce something wine-related, and they'll completely mangle it. Like the other day, somebody ordered a bottle of Chablis for me. And of course, you know, it's Chablis, and you go and get the bottle, and you point it out, and you say it right. And at least for a year when I started working in restaurants, my dad would tell all of his friends, "My daughter is a Somalia." So we're all used to translating mispronounced words in this business, but there's a category of wine words that's more challenging than the rest. Well, I took to the streets and I got non-wine people to give their best shot at pronouncing some of Germany's most famous vineyards. And now for the game. This is good practice for taking orders on the floor. Can you name that German vineyard?
How often do you drink wine?
As often as I can.
Have you ever drank wine from Germany?
I don't know.
Well, there's amazing wines in Germany, and they usually come from single vineyards with incredible names. And I have a couple names here, and I was wondering if you could read them off for me.
All right, honey. Eidelbacher? Karthauserhof?
Very good.
Eidelbacher, Karthauserhof?
Eidelbacher, Karthauserhof? No, not that one.
Eidelbacher, Karthauserhof?
Eidelbacher, Karthauserhof?
Eidelbacher, Karthauserhof? Eidelbacher, Karthauserhof?
So we've got that. Eidelbacher, Karthauserhof.
The Urzugu words can sounds like I've had that before.
Urziger Wurstgarten? Urzigen? Wurstgarten?
Urziger Wurzganter?
Urzinger? Wurzgarten?
Urziger Wurzgarten. Ziger. Urziger Wurzgarten.
Urziger Wurzgarten?
Pierce Porten. Gold Troop Fuck.
the Peace Porten. Golden Fluffin. That sounds really familiar. I think we've got a bottle of that at home.
Pierce Porter. Gold Troop. Gold Trooper Shen. Pierce Porcher, Gold Trooper Shen. That's a hard one.
Weiss Porten, Gold Trooper.
The next one is Pierce Porten. It sounds dirty, doesn't it? Golden Focker? Golden Focker. Golden. Gold Trooper. These are long-ass words. Peace Porter Gold Troopchen.
Peel Porter Gold Troopchen.
Peace Porten Gold Troopchen.
Weihainer and Sornaher.
And Valenin Sornuher? I couldn't tell you if I've had that one. I don't think so, though.
Welliner Sornenur.
Welliner Suriner. These are long words. Weihilner. Weihilner. Sonner.
Wehlemon Sonner. Sonner.
Weihilner. I guess that's Sonnenur. Okay.
So how did you do? Could you guess all of the German vineyards? Well, now for an added bonus, I got some people to try and say plant nutrient in German.
Pflanzenstallgemittel.
It's a lot of letters, and it seems very difficult to pronounce.
Pflanzenstallgemittel?
Pflanzenstallgemittel?
Oh, honey, that's a long one. Pflanzenstallgemittel.
Plansenstarkungsmittel.
The correct pronunciation is Plansenstarkungsmittel. And one last one. The longest German word I know is the word for flossing your teeth. It literally translates to teeth between to take care of. The correct pronunciation is Zahnzwischenraumpflegen. Let's see what we get.
Zahnzwischenraumpflegen?
That's one word?
That's one word.
Zahnzwischenraumpflegen.
Sandwichenraumhager?
Zahnzwischenraumpflegen.
Zahnzwischenraumpflegen.
Let me see. Zahnzwischenraumpflegen.
That's a long one. That's a long word. Zahnzwischenraumpflegen.
Well, thank goodness for the German language, because it exercises parts of our palate that might never get used otherwise.
750's on a roll. They're in California, they're in Colorado, they're in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, offering wholesale pricing data and a searchable format to buyers in those states. We spoke with one, Jordan Salcido. Hello.
Hello.
Of the Momofuku Group, had a few things to say about her use of the 750 service.
I just want to say thank you to 750 for making my life about 1,000 times easier than it ever was before. Instead of dealing with lots and lots of stacks of printed books, usually of several of which are out of date, I have access to all of that information with the click of a button. You've made my life a lot easier. You've saved me a countless number of hours in the brief amount of time, I would say 6 months, that I've been fortunate to work with you. Thanks so much.
750, saving so many hours, saving rainforest paper. Thank you very much, Jordan Salcido of the Momofuku Group, a 750 user. Grant Reynolds on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me, Levy.
Nice to see you here.
You too.
Long-time listener, first-time guest.
Exactly. I love it.
So you grew up in Lake Placid, is that the story?
I did, yeah. Yeah, born and raised Lake Placid, New York. And I guess that was... And I moved from Lake Placid when I was 18, and haven't really been back since, to tell you the truth. But
what was it like there back in the day?
Lake Placid's kind of a funny town. It's, you know, the home of the Olympics 2 times. And that being said, it's really has, it's totally a tourist town, ski town, but with, you know, not exactly the same excitement that you get in a place like Aspen or Tahoe, any of those big places. So it's still like pretty sleepy, not exactly in its heyday any longer, but needless to say, it's beautiful, full of, just restaurants, hotels, and that sort of thing. So,
Were you doing the restaurant thing back then?
I was, yeah. It's funny. I think like trying to think if there was any friend of mine who wasn't working in restaurants or working with the Olympic venues to any degree. There really wasn't much else to do there other than maybe get in a little bit of youthful trouble and work. So everybody started pretty young, and restaurants were always looking for people to wash dishes or do any of those glamorous jobs that we all kind of start with. So I think my first restaurant job was when I was 13, totally illegal, working like 2 hours in the morning at this to-go Italian place, like seeding tomatoes and peeling garlic. And then I'd run.
So not much has changed, really.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I know. It totally comes full circle. You know? So, yeah, I know. But for a little while, I like swore off tomatoes and garlic. The smell of them alone made me totally nauseous. But
so if you pass out in the dining room of Charlie Bird on a busy Saturday, we'll know why.
Yeah, it was the gnocchi. Totally screwed me. But no, it was cool. So, worked in really, really like casual kind of hometown restaurants growing up there. And yeah, did that, everything from like delivering pizzas to a busboy to being, making sandwiches, you name it, all sorts of stuff. Really up until when I was 16, that was pretty much that. It's like skiing, working in restaurants, and just being a kid in a small town.
What happened when you turned 16?
When I turned 16, like most people, was super frustrated by being in a small town.
Life.
Exactly.
Parents.
Totally.
Job. Bush.
Bush, for sure. Hated that guy. I decided to that was funny. You know, I don't know. In our high school, we always had these foreign exchange students. And they were always, like, super nice people. Usually, like, kind of awkward and didn't speak much English from, you know, all over the place. And there was a program called AFS. And I thought or just asked, you know, one of the foreign exchange students, like, how he got to come to Lake Placid. This kid from Japan, super nice guy, right? And he's like, through this program, AFS. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll try and do that myself. And one thing led to another. I signed up, got accepted. And next thing I knew, they give you a choice of a few different countries. And I had taken like Spanish classes in upstate New York. So I by no means had learned much Spanish, but for whatever reason thought I was, you know, on the verge of being fluent. So I was like,
in El Hombre.
Exactly. I was like, you know, I don't want to go to Spain. I don't really want to go to South America. I was still kind of a, you know, pretty sheltered white kid. So I was like,
he's like, Nicaragua doesn't sound like much
no
fun.
Chance. No chance.
Yeah.
But I did know I wanted
could
to
could have been a whole different life, dude.
I know, man.
You could be heroin smuggling now.
Exactly.
You could
glamorous,
be like,
greasy hair.
You know, part of the Zetas or something.
Totally.
Like, you know?
Totally. Looking back, you, that, know? You know.
Gangster kingpin.
Hacienda
style, like that guy in Scarface,
yeah.
You know?
I'm flattered that you think I could cut it, but
I'm just saying.
I don't know.
Could have been a whole different world.
Totally. Yeah. Oh, that's crazy. But yeah, so I ended up getting shipped off to Italy. And that was my junior year of high school.
Was that like one of the situations where like the number two pencil didn't read on the Scantron? It was like Spain or Italy.
Exactly.
And you're like, oh, I didn't fill in the circle completely.
I know.
So
I don't
it
know
went
what
to
happened.
The other country.
I know. Italy was like, I have no connection to Italy. My parent, like, heritage is, you know, pretty like waspy English, blah, blah, blah.
I think you're the only guy who's worked in an Italian restaurant who's come on the show and hasn't told me the story about his grandmother making pasta gravy or
no chance.
His grandfather making wine in a basement.
Yeah,
so.
No, not at all. My grandma made like hot dogs and, you know, like goulash. That was more her steez.
So it must have been a big change.
Yeah, it was a huge change. Wow. So like total shock. So I moved. They sent me, well, you know, they send you to a family, a host family, and I really had no idea where I was going. Of course, as like a 16-year-old kid with, you know, whose sole interest was girls and, you know, trying to party at that point.
Sure.
I thought I was going to be like in the club life in Milan, like living
right.
up when they told me I was going to Northern Italy, but...
the club life in Milan.
Yeah, I don't know. It wasn't that, needless to say. But I was sent to...
Late night parties at the Duomo, son.
Exactly. yeah, too much GQ or whatever at that point. But I was sent to a really small town on Lago Maggiore in Piemonte. Kind of a... What's now sort of a dead industrial town right on the Swiss border. But needless to say, super beautiful. Not really in any... There's like a little bit of wine that's grown there, but a little too far north. Than,
for high quality is what you're
for
saying.
For high quality, yeah. There's a lot of swell. But needless to say, beautiful, had a great time. Was thrown right into a high school there, having not like known, you know, more than two words of Italian, and that was it. It was like full immersion. It was crazy.
What are those
experience.
Two words, Mario Batali?
Yes.
You're like, I can speak Italian.
Totally.
Multi-
I
Mario.
Love this guy with my orange Crocs. I came over. Yeah, it's totally the American fashion. But yeah, it was fun. It was.
How long
were
you there?
Good experience. I was there for 10 months, so full school year.
It was a pretty long time.
It was a really long time, and the first 2 months. It was like a little, you know, I felt like a mute. It's like it was just remote enough where, you know, people I didn't speak much English at all, which I was surprised by in my sort of ignorance and arrogance for that matter. But it was a struggle the first couple of months, just like being in a high school where you're just, people are yammering on about stuff that, one, I've never heard of, and two, it's in a totally different language. So I figured out quick, like,
the language. Needless to say, you kind of have to. It's like sink or swim. And then from there, it was like, you know, for sure one of the great experiences, whether I knew it then or not, that has really helped me with my life. So
was it like
super fun.
A normal high school or?
No, it was, it's funny. So in Europe, you have to decide really what your career path is going to be after what the equivalent of our like middle school is. So in Italy, they have in high school, they'll split it up whether you're in like art school or, I mean, even, you know, culinary hospitality school or engineering, which was the one that they put me in for whatever reason. I have no idea because I had pretty much, you know, standard grades across the board and expressed no interest in any particular subject. But that's, you know, where they threw me, probably where there was space. And so I was like in, yeah, taking like trigonometry and physics and, you know, classes that I still don't even know, like surveying and all sorts of crazy stuff in Italian. So needless to say, I didn't learn a single thing as far as academics go other than the language.
But when you look at the slope of La Tosche, you're like, you know, I think I can measure that pretty well.
Totally. I see those guys out there with the instruments. I'm like, that guy's no idea what he's doing.
Yeah,
no,
I got this covered.
In the orange vest. Exactly. Step aside, buddy. Your line is crooked. But yeah, it was cool. It was super fun. But I lived with a really generous family. And the wife was a super great cook. Just cooking, you know, classic Italian stuff. You'd get to, like, school would cut short at, I think it was 12:30 every day. But you went to school 6 days a week. Go home, have lunch, pass out, wake up, and then kind of, I don't know, fool around for a little bit and have dinner and call it a day. So it was pretty routine. I packed on a few pounds thanks to all that pasta, and that was that. Yeah, it was
were you like fun. Having trouble translating, like, I need the tailor
exactly
to take these pants out.
Yeah, thankfully I was probably only wearing sweatpants at that point,
right. Well, it was cool back then.
Yeah, exactly.
So then you move back to the States.
Yeah.
And what goes down?
I had one more year of high school to finish up in Lake Placid, and so my senior year of high school and looking at colleges and everything. And I'd grown up being a sort of competitive skier and thought that was going to be the route that I would pursue more than anything. So I applied to one college, and it was the University of Colorado in Boulder.
Is there a secret society of sommeliers who really like to ski in New York?
There is, man. Like, there's some
Dustin, great, Liz Ouellette,
totally.
Bobby Stuckey,
influence. Yeah, it's funny. I don't know. I think like there's a lot of great sommeliers in Aspen and in Colorado for that matter. And I don't know.
Yeah. Part of the reason they end up there is because they had an interest in skiing.
It's a great lifestyle. You know, it's a really great lifestyle. It's fun to ski with those guys.
The only hard part is sabering while you're skiing down a slope.
Exactly. Yeah. And the long lunch break where you're then too drunk to ski home. But it was fun. This past year, I got to go skiing with a bunch of those guys for the La Palais out in Aspen that they do every year. And you're like skiing with Christophe Roumier and Jean-Pierre Desmet and all those guys. Like, it was super cool. Aspen was like full of sommeliers and winemakers, and
where they like, we used to be able to do this in Chablis before global warming.
Exactly. <You know? laughs> That's great. It's funny. Yeah. But
so eventually you did hook up with Bobby out in Colorado. How did that kind of happen?
Yeah. So I'd like moved out there and needed to work, you know, needless to say, the skiing thing competitively, I gave up on it, or it gave up on me, either way. And so I looked to restaurants. And started working in a restaurant out there that was, you know, really well regarded as far as Boulder goes, a great spot still today called The Kitchen. Just bussing tables and, you know, eventually became a bartender, barista, that whole deal there for a couple of years. And
does that equal lunchtime bartender? Is that what that means?
It does, man.
The barista bartender double shift.
I'm telling you, like being in college and having to work Saturday, Sunday brunch, 8 a.m. juicing, making like 300 cappuccinos. That no one's I don't envy that. I can make a great cappuccino now. I'll pat myself on the back for that. But that really sucked.
People weren't coming in asking you for Krug.
No, no, none of that. People are angry at brunch.
Yeah,
for the most part, especially college kids. But then they lighten up a little bit later on in the day.
Yeah, it takes an hour.
Yeah,
and some eggs and some grease.
Exactly. But I was sympathetic, so I was usually in their same position. But so I was there and had been at that restaurant for a few years, and they had a really great education program, and I was still underage at that point, and I don't know if they knew that or they definitely didn't know that. And so, yeah, I got to, you know, go to like what was standard, but at that point for me, something really interesting, like both beer and wine education classes. And it kind of just sparked my interest as a whole. And, you know, like anyone, I think I totally resented restaurants. And, you know, the reason I went to college was probably to do anything but work in a restaurant. And you know, I'm sure I've said this in public, but like totally had sworn it off, you know, and was really looking to get out of it. But the whole wine thing really, like, I don't know, it connected a lot of different parts of my life, and I had a general interest in it. So it really kind of took off at that restaurant, and they said that, well, I had met Bobby and his wife Danette. They would come in for brunch all the
time.
They would come in for brunch. Yeah, that's like their routine. Frasca's closed on Sundays, and those two work incredibly hard, so that was like their thing, and it was a great brunch. And there was a great young bartender there making cappuccinos. And
yeah, they're like, these are some nice cappuccinos.
Exactly. So I had like met him and had heard about him and all of his allure and great character, and had heard about Frasca and knew about it and kind of like talked to him a little bit. And I was thinking of making sort of the next step, you know, just had been at that restaurant for a little while, and in life in general was, you know, had finished my first couple of years of college, just taking like any and every course of liberal arts, and really had no particular major or focus at that point. Bobby, I think it was Bobby who mentioned that they were doing the intro exam for the quartermaster sommeliers up in Aspen. And it was like 2 weeks after I had turned 21, and the kitchen, they like paid for half of it, and if you passed, and so I
big incentive to pass.
I know, right? Exactly. Things are expensive, man. A couple $100 back then, but So I went up to Aspen, and that was I had met Bobby a little bit and took the intro exam, 100% pass rate that time. So it was super positive, but that's where I really like met, more than anything, you know, I'd learned a little bit more about wine over those couple of days, but met people like Richard Betts and Jay Fletcher and Bobby for that matter, and really saw like a different side of the restaurant industry, something that was, you know, smart and professional, and that looked like it could prove itself in the long term. So it was really encouraging. And I came back to Boulder, called up Bobby and just asked if I could, you know, like stage at Frasca. So he said, for sure. And that was kind of my intro into Frasca. Was Friday nights, I would have sheepishly stand at the wine station, and they'd hand me bottles of wine to open and then eventually decant. And one thing led to another. I got to kind of start working the floor with those guys. And then I asked for a full-time job at Frasca, and that's where that led. So, yeah, it was kind of a sort of a seamless transition, with the exception that when I was a stage, I was like, you know, all in the wine department, obviously unpaid. But then when I took the full-time job, you start from the ground up there, really, no matter what, which I think is, you know, was a positive thing for me at that point, because I never worked as an expo or a back waiter or a waiter in that kind of fine dining environment, which, looking back, like, you know, totally super helpful in any restaurant environment to have the basis of that. So my timing was great, just, you know, as a expo, and then quickly moved up to being a bartender was the first thing, having that little bit of experience at the kitchen. And then as a bartender, I would do like a couple of shifts on the weekends. It was like Friday, Saturday, as what the position was called, like a wine back. So sort of like a assistant sommelier, whatever that be. But I would help out Matthew Mather, the wine director there, a guy named Ben Richardson, and Bobby on the floor. And thanks to those guys, they totally just took me under their wing. And yeah, it was like boot camp for a sommelier. So,
how would you sum up Fresca as a restaurant if no one had been there before, if someone that you were talking to had been there before?
Yeah, Fresca is a really a special place considering where it is. You have a lot of really, really talented people who maybe like don't want to live in a big city and still want to work in an environment who that like pushes you every day and challenges you. So Frasca is, it's an Italian restaurant, of course, based on Friuli, so northeastern Italy. And it is, it's beyond casual at this point, beyond a neighborhood restaurant. But it's not totally fine dining. So it's like a four-course briefy menu with a huge focus on wine. And yeah, it's kind of, I don't know of any like big name comparisons to it, but for where it's at, they like push the envelope every day and work super hard, both in the kitchen and in the front of the house. And you're in Boulder, Colorado, which is, you know, they're like, it's kind of an uphill battle for a lot of people out there because sort of the culture, and I mean, it's changed a lot over the last few years, but it was like really the like steakhouse Midwest kind of culture. And here you put this like kind of like esoteric Italian region in, you know, the middle of Colorado, and you're serving Italian white wines exclusively by the glass and Italian red wines exclusively by the glass. People like kind of turn their heads, but a little bit of like, yeah, coaching and encouragement to the guests, and they created a really really special place. It's a fun place.
How many times did you misspell Friuli in your early career?
I have no idea. Yeah. I remember thinking like Frasca, like having learned Italian when I was abroad. I was like, those guys totally misspelled Fresca. Like the classic. And then I was like, oh,
you're like,
shit.
Bobby, let's have a little talk.
Yeah, I was like, Bobby, I gotta tell you something, man.
Yeah, I know Italian.
I know Italian. And I know I'm not the first. People have like said that multiple times. So, you know, they walk in, they're like, these guys like try to be Italian and they can't even spell Fresca right. You're like, no, it's actually, it is a word, Fresca.
They're like, is this that place by Soto?
Exactly.
Scotto, Fresco by Scotto, sorry.
But yeah, it was great. And, you know, I really, the cool thing about that restaurant was you had some really like super talented people who, you know, Bobby and Matthew, for sure, who had worked in, you know, some of the greatest restaurants around the country. And for me, it wasn't, you know, it's not the high-stress environment, which I think a lot of sommeliers and wine directors might have in these big cities. So it was, like, it's Colorado. It was much so much more low-key, which for me, somebody, like, trying to learn was made everything super accessible. You know, we had days off. We had, you know, didn't have to show up to work, you know, until 4 o'clock for that matter. And so it made like learning and made studying and made that really, really accessible. And I think that's one of the reasons you see a lot of great sommeliers come out of Frasca, and a lot of people pass the master sommelier exam in Colorado for that matter, because you have a lot of really smart, really motivated people
who, you know, can kind of like take the time to study and learn about wine and do all those things without the pressure of living in a big city.
The sheer business of the big city.
For sure. But
so eventually you kind of moved to a different venue, which was interesting.
Yeah. So I decided after I graduated, and needless to say, it took me a long time to get through college, because at Frasca, I had really decided that I wanted to pursue wine and pursue restaurants. So I started going to school part-time, would like take morning classes and then work at night. And it was a demanding job. I should never discredit that. But I started to travel a lot, and you know, needless to say, it took me a couple of extra years to get through school. So at that point, I was ready to move on from Boulder, and had a great conversation with Bobby at that point, and he encouraged me to go to Europe first and try and work Harvest somewhere, and maybe try and work in a restaurant in Europe, and then from there kind of go to New York or go to San Francisco to you know, work at, you know, in a different environment. So I did that in August of 2012. I left Frasca and I went to Burgundy. So the harvest of 2012, the lovely Cess family at Domaine Dujac,
in Burgundy.
Domaine Dujac, yeah, exactly, in Meurthe-Saint-Denis. And I was a harvest intern there, which entailed me picking for, I think it was like 5 or 6 days, which is totally a grind, and you know, one of the more challenging things as far as work goes that I've done, simply because I've never done any sort of like farm work or manual labor for that matter. Kind of a softie on that end, but it was a great experience. Super cool to see the vineyards like that up close and personal, and just the whole culture of pickers and everything. But above that, the great thing about that experience was, you know, beyond like learning a little bit about the winemaking process and getting your hands dirty and all that, which was incredible. But to have I think we were there for at least 4 weeks, and the Cess family was super, super generous with their wine cellar and just with us as a whole. So we stayed right at the Domaine. There was about 4 of us, and you know, with their larger family, so usually like 10 people around the table every night, with a great chef, this gentleman who writes for Fine Wine Magazine, the food editor, came down and cooked dinner for us every night, cooked lunch for us every day for that matter. And we would get to drink, you know, out of that incredible, incredible cellar that they have. So super, super great opportunity for myself, and really one of the, you know, great opportunity for anybody if you ever have the chance to drink wines of that age and of that sort of allure, that you one know are real, have been stored well, and with someone like Jeremy and his father Jacques and his brother Alec and Roz, who just have so much information, not only on Burgundy, but the Rhone and Bordeaux and Germany, and you know, all over you. And every night we're drinking really, really great stuff. And yeah, that was incredible. So that was, you know, about 4 weeks, and probably next to the 10 months I spent in Italy, it was the longest time I had lived in Europe. I did a couple of like short stints here and there, but that was, yeah, man, really just an incredible experience to be with all those people. And from there, I went to Noma in Copenhagen, where I had really signed up for a stage, an unpaid position again, to work for 2 months in the front of house at Noma during the Scandinavian winter,
little did I know that was dark and cold and kind of the most depressing time of year to be there. But
they didn't put that in a brochure.
No, no. They didn't tell me that when I requested post-harvest. But yeah, that was, wow, what an experience. So I went up to Noma towards like the middle of October and pretty much just hit the ground running. I rented a room on Airbnb in Copenhagen, and it was in, well, I mean, I had no idea. I'd never been to Copenhagen before. It was in kind of a seedy part of the city. You know, nothing like to ever be afraid of, but certainly not luxurious. And I rented it with this old English couple, and the guy had been like a boxer back in his heyday, and he's now, God, I don't know how old, but had taken a few blows to the head, and she was this like totally eccentric, out there, like hoarder of a woman, and I had this like tiny little bed, and would go to work at what was then, you know, called the best restaurant in the world every day. Just like the degree of, you know,
divergence between those two worlds
was incredible.
It's like Oliver Twist. Totally. It's like the end of Great Expectations exactly. On the other side. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But yeah, you're working so hard that, you know, you don't really need anything more than a bed and a place to crash. Exactly. I was lucky enough to have that.
Window shades that can be pulled down.
Totally. So yeah, that was cool. I was in Copenhagen for just over 2 months. Right up until they took their Christmas break.
What was the Noma scene like?
Noma is incredible. You know, I think the great, you know, one of the reasons I decided I wanted to go to Noma was one, because I thought I'd want to work there and live in Europe, potentially, and two, obviously to just have that experience. But Noma has a wine list that I had like looked at, and just looking at wine lists, you know, as we all do. And there was like so many producers that I had either never heard of, never had access to, or you know, had read about and heard sort of like, you know, mysterious things about. And so I was like, wow, if I could, you know, somehow get my hands into that scene, it'd be great to learn about, you know, the controversial natural wine. It's in Colorado. Like, I think Frasca does an incredible job of bringing in wines. You know, we get to travel. I traveled with Bobby and Lachlan to Friuli a handful of times to like find new producers and try and get them imported and do that. But I mean, they've done an incredible job doing that for as far as Italy goes. But it's, you know, Colorado and New York and San Francisco really scoop up like a lot of those tiny allocations of wine. And there's, you know, I got to drink a lot of great stuff at Frasca, especially considering, you know, my age and where we were at, incredible wines. But, you know, it was like a huge occasion to get to try even Dovisat and Ravano and that sort of thing. You just couldn't get it.
Is that,
you know,
true?
Jamais. Yeah, totally. It's crazy being here in New York. You know, those wines.
We're like every day. You're like, every oh, day. Look.
Every day.
It's little so, Dovi, little Ravi.
Exactly. Casually in wine stores. And you just didn't have that. So, yeah, that was, you know, again, one of the reasons why I really wanted to go to Dushak was Eric Railsback had told me sort of and legendary stories of the wines that he got to drink. And I knew that I had to.
Jeremy's like, wouldn't it be nice to try some Barolo? Because he doesn't try that much.
Exactly.
Like, no, bro.
I know. I
like, where's no the Chablis at?
Exactly. Yeah, we did a fun dinner at his house one night where we drank some Italian wine. And
he's Jeremy, into it. He goes.
He's super into it. Yeah. Super into it. Super into Montalcino. Of course, he like goes, you know, full force. The guy, like, yeah, he's incredibly smart. Oxford grad. So it's like, he's really into it, and he knows his stuff, and travels there now and everything. So I did drink some really great Italian wine at Dushak, but I knew I needed to drink some Burgundy and drink those things in order to learn and kind of catch up. But and that was sort of my same philosophy as to why I'd want to go to NOMA. And
what was the wine program like?
Wine program at NOMA. Well, first, you know, I was a stage there, so I, you know, showed up and sort of like really enthusiastically. And NOMA's a really positive restaurant. The people who work there, it's like, you know, young people, super motivated. That was like one of the great things I learned about. It was super encouraging is that they've created this culture of young people and maybe, you know, people think it's like militant and kind of brainwashed and whatever, but you have these kids who are literally working 18 hours a day. Some of the guys in the kitchen, the front of the house, we didn't work that much, but you work really hard, really, really hard in a super demanding environment, but it's really positive and, you know, everybody's so excited to be there. So that was encouraging to see that, you know, much enthusiasm over a restaurant. But I showed up and I definitely was not like pulling corks, you know, day one at all. I was like polishing silverware and that kind of thing. But, you know, I think I have some strong restaurant experience, especially coming out of Frasca. And
really? You got any garlic I could peel back
exactly.
there?
Exactly.
I've been doing it since I was 13. No.
It's like too bad they don't use tomatoes.
right.
Some cans of tomatoes. But
they're like, what are these for an object?
Exactly. But yeah, I did like pick herbs and grass and all that stuff that you hear about, but that's a whole different story. I was in the front of the house and started running food and kind of made friends with the sommeliers there and with everybody just like going out and I guess I kind of, however you know, as a sommelier, prove yourself and, you know, just like having a good time and drink fun wine. There's a great wine bar there called Vidstradentin, which I'd go to by myself and crush a bottle of wine as often as possible. And you just get to know people that way. So after a little while, they became like super open to me being more involved with wine at the restaurant, whether it was just like pouring wine pairings and doing that sort of thing with wines that I ultimately had like very little experience with. And that's because the wine program there, which is run by a gentleman named Mas and a guy named John, two great young sommeliers who are super motivated, has a focus on natural wine, let's say, and has a focus on, you know, smaller producers from lesser known regions and incredibly, you know, wines that I think are can be very controversial for a lot of people. And things like, you know, Metros, which we all know and love, but you don't see in the US anymore. And then a handful of natural producers not using sulfur and biodynamic and all of those, you know, sound bites for what it is. But the wine program there, I think, you know, whether or not I agree with all of those wines, or, you know, enjoy them, or do I think a lot of them may have had, you know, what somebody would call a flaw, like oxidation and those sort of things, is that it really does make sense for the food and for that environment. You know, those wines they're challenging if you're used to a particular type of wine. And yeah, there are some wines which I think were you know, totally flawed that were poured in the wine pairing menu. But you can't discredit, you know, what somebody's focus is and whether or not. But so they would, it would be probably like 95% of the wine service there was tasting menu. You have 40 guests for two services a day. So lunch and dinner, everybody does the equivalent of like 20 courses, you know, no options. You sit down and go. And it's a diner that at this point isn't, you know, necessarily like wine focused, but more focused on just the restaurant, of the overall experience. And so wine pairings, I think, really made sense and were encouraged by them to do. So, you know, they, that being said, the role of a sommelier there was more just to, like, be kind of a captain and
make sure
and
the wine around. Was poured before
yeah,
the course
make sure
came.
The wine was poured.
Maybe
but
explain it.
Servers, exactly. Servers would pour wine too. And so I got to, you know, as I was, like, my first couple of weeks just running food, kind of.
But you weren't like
jumped
flipping
in.
Through the list with customers being like,
no.
Maybe you could have this, maybe you could have that,
no,
maybe you could
no.
have this. Because only, exactly. It was a set thing.
Yeah, it was a set thing. And only on a couple of occasions did I like flip through that. That was really like,
you're like, what is this
guys.
Thing?
Exactly.
All right. I haven't seen this book for a while.
I know. You would, it would, yeah, there'd be nights where nobody would ever look at a wine list. And yeah, so I was there. Doing that whole thing at Noma, more for, you know, the experience of working in that environment, and to like definitely try and learn about wines that I'd never had and you know, had heard of like many different opinions and try and formulate my own opinion on natural wine and on, you know, just that whole culture right now, which is going on in Europe. And you know, now it's like all over New York, and I'm sure it's probably been in New York longer than it's been, you know, in Paris or in those places. But it was really, really prominent in Copenhagen. The whole city is flooded with, for better or worse, you know, depending on your own opinion, is flooded with natural wine. I mean, anywhere you go now, they kind of whisk away a lot of really great wines in lieu of, you know, these other producers. But more than anything, Noma was an experience in working in that environment as, you know, somebody in the front of the house. So I was there for 2 months and, ran food, and eventually they kind of let me, run a section as a waiter. And, I did that really for like the last few weeks, which I was there. And, that was up until December. I got offered a job at Noma to come back full time. And I very, very much thought about taking that job, but knew I had to come back home and sort out a visa and, you know, pay off a credit card and try and make some money before.
Stuff.
Yeah, real world stuff. God, I was so broke in Copenhagen. But then, yeah, so I came back in December, so right around Christmas time. And I grew up, having grown up in Lake Placid, I came back to the East Coast and figured that I would move to New York with what was maybe only going to be a couple of months or what was maybe going to be full time. So my family has an apartment here, so it was really, really, you know, fortunate and easy transition for me to be able to move to New York without any money and try and look for a job to make some scratch and maybe move to Scandinavia and just ultimately to make the decision of what I was going to do next.
And what did that turn out to be?
Man, New York smacked me in the face. I think I got here on December 30th. I was only in Lake Placid for a couple of days and then came down. So I knew I had to work and try and look for a job super quick. And my first night, I met a gentleman in Burgundy that worked Harvest with me, a guy named Max Kogod.
Oh, sure, Max.
Yeah. Yeah. Who is now a great friend of mine and was at that point really the only person that I knew in New York. So like first night, he had just moved to New York too and just started working at Crush. And my first night, we went to... Is it J.G. Mellon?
Not far from here, actually.
Not far, yeah, exactly. He's like, let's go to the spot, like, great burgers.
It's funny,
you know?
I went there a few times when I first moved to New York, too.
Did it?
Yeah. It must be like a rite of passage or something.
Exactly. So we, like, went there and had a burger. This is my first night in New York.
And then you're like, oh, shit, I have to pay in cash?
Exactly.
Did that happen?
That totally happened. I was, like, on the iPhone making a transfer from the credit card.
Yeah,
I was like, oh shit, this is no more credit card. But that was my first night, right? And I just got to New York and all my stuff was in bags. And in college, I studied I studied like film and photography and that sort of thing. So I had a good amount of camera gear that I used to travel with all the time. And I was at my parents' apartment where I was staying and where I ended up living for a few months. And it's on 81st and Columbus, right? So like a nice neighborhood.
Yeah, actually pretty nice neighborhood.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice neighborhood. And night one in New York after, you know, like being here and thinking life's like pretty good.
Yeah.
I walk home to an apartment which had been broken into.
Wow, dude.
And literally my first night. And whether it was me like just spacing out and not locking the door, but or not, but I think they, you know, however they did it, broke into the house, stole all my computer gear, stole all my camera gear, and even stole the one suit that I had brought down from upstate for a few interviews that I had over the next couple of days. And that was my welcome to New York, a big slap in the face. And then the next day, I need to say, like, called the cops, was up all night with the police. The next day, I had a meeting with Robert Bohr, who I had met in Burgundy and had met in at Frasca, just like casually at a couple of dinners here and there, but who I reached out to just to, you know, see if he had known of any opportunities in New York and that sort of thing.
Were you wearing your boxer shorts in the interview?
Just about, man.
Sorry about the wife beater, man.
Just about. Yeah, but I was definitely like glossy eyed and not feeling super hot when.
Did you call him Sipowitz a couple times by mistake? You're like, Sergeant Sipowitz. I mean Robert. Exactly. I'm just trying to fill out the form here.
No, it was funny. So I met him, and that night I was like, told him, I was like, hey man, I just want to let you know I look a little beat up right now because frankly, I just got my ass kicked by New York.
By New York. Yeah.
It was a good welcome. But it was funny. The next, that same night, he's like, you know what? He's like, I'll show you a different side of New York tonight. And it was New Year's Eve. And he invited me to go to the Jay-Z concert. And, you know, what was only 24 hours later, I was like backstage with a dirty sweater and bad shoes with, you know, Robert and Daniel Hume and a bunch of, I was like, this is, New York is a crazy, crazy place. You know, you can like get broken into. And then the next night, it's like, for whatever reason, I, you know, was living a life that I'm super fortunate and only ever dreamed of, or not living, but, you know, being exposed to, and just having a great time. Like having what was equivalently of like the worst night to, you know, one of the great nights that of my life. And that juxtaposition was just totally bizarre, but
you're like, I got 99 problems and this concert ain't one.
Exactly. Well put. So yeah, that was my first couple of days in New York, and as a side note, it's only been on the up since.
What do you think about New York as a you know, a wine place? Like, you know, traveled around a little bit, you know, you come, you take a look. I always find that people's impressions when they first move are always really distinct. Whereas later you're like, I don't know. I mean, it's complex. There's this, there's that. But when you first move, you have like opinions. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I had expectations, you know, and you hear about people and just like telling them, I might move to New York. Like, you know, man, like, New York's crazy. You can, the stuff you'll get to drink in New York and the people there, and it's like I'd only heard positive things. You know, of course you hear it's like cutthroat and you're gonna work hard and all that stuff, but I had like only heard positive things, and it showed me all of that, you know, like what the wines I've been exposed to, both at like the highest end level, with very generous collectors and that sort of thing, to stuff that, you know, we were referencing earlier, stuff that like, you know, isn't necessarily an expensive wine, but is incredibly rare and sought after. And to be able to find that in stores like Crush or Chamber Street and that kind of thing is just like incredible, you know. I think the wine scene in New York is incredible. I have no complaints. And also the people who work in it. It's like I've gotten to meet a couple of sommeliers. Being at Frasca, Bobby's like, you know, friends with everybody, and so a lot of those people would roll through, and but you know, like I think, yeah, week one, being able to go up to Barbalude and hang out with Michael and like have those crazy wines by the glass that he pours all the time and that sort of thing is like priceless. And I think anybody here should take advantage of all that sort of stuff. And I still think New York is, you know, yeah, I've been here for what, 6 or 7 months now, and every day it's, you know, I get to try another wine that I may have never gotten to try had I not been in New York. That's kind of the way I look at it. And I think, yeah, as a whole, the restaurant industry in New York is super positive, and it's full of a lot of fun, colorful people across the board.
So. What's the Charlie Bird thing like?
Charlie Bird. Man, Charlie Bird's a blast. It's been, I don't know, as we're talking now, I guess this is like week 8, so kind of our second month. I got, you know, to backtrack a little bit, I got hired by Robert really like towards, you know, mid-January, that sort of thing, with the scope of working at Charlie Bird. Had a couple of different interviews and a couple of other things that happened that really made me decide I wanted to be in New York. But more than anything, I decided to be in New York to work at Charlie Bird. And to work with Robert and Ryan, who's the chef there, Ryan Hardy, just an incredible guy and super talented and super positive, really nice guy. So Charlie Bird started in January, I guess, and I would go to like design meetings and we worked a few private events and did that sort of thing. But needless to say, I was kind of living a really charmed and you know, super just fun life, thanks to the generosity of more than anyone, Robert, over the last few months. He totally like took me under his wing and showed me a lot of great things about New York before the restaurant opened. So Charlie Bird has been now, it's a whole experience. But as a restaurant, we've been open for 8 weeks, and it's a blast. It's super fun. So it's totally a different environment than what I've worked in, at least in the past, going from Rosca and then to Noma and restaurants that are, you know, like tasting menus and really like full of all the mechanics of service and pretty formal in their scope. Charlie Bird is so much more casual than I think most people would ever expect it to be. Having, you know, if they know Robert's experience and Ryan's experience, who was at the Little Nell and running that program there for a long time. So it is, yeah. So we're on 6th Ave in Houston. On King Street is our address, but the entrance on 6th Ave there, this beautiful old space in New York with kind of a like polished industrial feel to it, exposed brick and all that stuff, but really, really well designed. I think the space is beautiful, but it's not fancy by any means. And the food, Ryan's food, is totally Italian inspired. The guy knows more about Italian food than I ever thought he would. Just he's super humble, and you know, having eaten at the Little Nell while he was there, never thought of him as like an Italian chef by any means. No, he's not, you know, calling himself an Italian chef, but there's a lot of influence in the food as far as that goes. So, meaning that he uses a lot of, it's like not a lot of butter, a lot of garlic and chili flake, a little bit of heat, fresh pasta and Rossi food and roasted meats and just the simplicity and authenticity of Italian food as a whole. So just no makeup and kind of rustic in its presentation to a certain degree, in today's world, I guess you could say. But yeah, it's fun. So the wine program there was totally contrived by Robert and my bit of influence. We, you know, having worked with a pretty massive wine list at Frasca, and you know, of course, Robert's resume entails, you know, Crew and Danielle and all of those incredible wine programs, kind of wanted to bring it back to a smaller wine list that's really concise and well edited and full of a lot of gems that aren't necessarily expensive, but that are, you know, maybe have some age on them or drinking well, and that you just wouldn't always see in that kind of environment. So more than anything, it's just to create a fun atmosphere where you can drink something great and have a couple of courses at your discretion, what you'd like to eat, and listen to hip hop, and you know, trust that the food is good and the service is dialed, and you know, have a great bottle of wine. So that's that. And hopefully, you know, every day, it's crazy. The opening a restaurant, the people like talk about how hard it is, and you know, I was like, yeah, come on. It's not gonna be that hard. Like, sure, I'll be working a lot, like that's cool, but it is like, it is as hard as anybody talks about. But it's also one of the most like exciting things to be a part of something from the start, you know. But it's all the little stuff that bogs you down, like, you know, things like having a dishwasher break, or you know, having your refrigeration show up late, and all these little things that, like, when you walk into a restaurant that's already gone through all of that and has infrastructure and has all of that, it's like, makes your life so much easier. But there's so much like positive things about being in a restaurant when it's young, and people are so excited to be there and check out what you're doing and kind of and give you a chance to show them what you got. And yeah, I think people have had a, you know, genuinely good time at Charlie Bird. I hope so, at least. And yeah, it's been fun. It's been really fun.
Speaking of young, how old are you?
I am 25. I turned 25 in May.
Congratulations.
Thanks, man.
Frasca, Noma.
Thanks.
Charlie Bird at 25.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels good. I got nothing but, yeah, I think, you know, just for whatever reason, been really fortunate to have a lot of great people like kind of take me under their wing. And man, I have so much to learn. Like, the people that I'm surrounded by are always there. But yeah, it's I feel like I'm in a good, fun place. And yeah.
Grant Reynolds, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you very much, Levy. Talk to you soon.
750's on a roll. They're in California, they're in Colorado, they're in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, offering wholesale pricing data and a searchable format to buyers in those states. We spoke with one, Jordan Salcido. Hello.
Hello.
Of the Momofuku Group, had a few things to say about her use of the 750 service.
I just want to say thank you to 750 for making my life about 1,000 times easier than it ever was before. Instead of dealing with lots and lots of stacks of printed books, usually of several of which are out of date, I have access to all of that information with the click of a button. You've made my life a lot easier. You've saved me a countless number of hours in the brief amount of time, I would say, you know, 6 months that I've been fortunate to work with you. Thanks so much.
750, saving so many hours, saving rainforest paper. Thank you very much, Jordan Salcido of the Momofuku Group, a 750 user.
You can find the show on iTunes, on Stitcher, and our own dedicated website, I'll drink to that pod.com. No apostrophe. Thanks for listening.